Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're
absolutely
uncomfortable talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. I'm guest host Nayla Ansari Cotillo with the main host, Jay, today. We're co-hosting.
Yeah,
this is
a pleasure,
awesome.
Nayla.
This is a pleasure. I feel like I'm with royalty today.
I think you must be talking about Dr. Watson.
Yes.
Right, of course.
And we're diving deep into Africana studies. Some folks also may know it as Black studies. And Dr. Watson, you are going to lead us through it today because we've been going through it. Yes, there's a lot going on in the U.S. today and every day, really, but particularly around education, Africana studies, book bans. And so we're going to dive deep into that today. But welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. I already like the great energy.
So where do you think Africana studies stands now in our current political climate?
Well, there is a palpable sense that it's under threat because of the current political climate. I think it also ironically feels like an opportunity to express the critical importance of it. You know, if there would be so much attention paid to it, and apparently such a felt threat by it, there must be something important about it. So I think we are at that point where, again, it feels like something urgent is happening around Africana studies.
So what do you think that urgency is? Does it feel like we're back into the origins of it, where it's a fight for us to still know who we are and understand our history?
Yeah, I think it's the origins of Africana studies. It feels that way in terms of the 1960s. But when we know more of the history of the country in general, I think it goes back further than that. If I may, it's reminding me of something I teach in my classes sometimes. This is from 1831. So, you know, 100+ years before the start of Africana studies. And if we know something about it real quick, in the 1960s, young Black folks and their allies from every background saw the importance of hearing from America's Africans, also known as Black people, because their voices and perspectives and histories and cultures were missing, you know, at colleges and universities. So in the 1960s, Africana studies was about bringing this missing perspective and the missing masses, you know, of us, so to speak, to campus. But even long before then, 1831, this is Henry Barry Esquire. He's speaking to the House delegates of Virginia, and he's a quote-unquote good one. You know, he's on the abolitionist side of things. He's speaking here about trying to get rid of slavery, or perhaps just make it less violent and fierce. But through his words, you know, we have a strong sense of what those running the slave system in our history, what they wanted in part. And here is what he says. He says, "Sir, we have, as far as possible, closed every avenue by which light might enter their minds. We have only to go one step further to extinguish the capacity to see the light, and our work would be completed. They would then be reduced to the level of the beasts of the field, and we should be safe." So I use that as a reference point because this is, again, 150 years plus before the 1960s, and we already have a window into the idea of trying to eliminate in the minds of America's Africans any insight they would have about themselves, right? About their history, about their culture, their language. And according to Henry Berry's words, for the goal of making them more compliant forced laborers, you know. So when we fast forward from there, the 1830s through the 1960s, then up till now, it does seem like there is a through line. You know, there's some kind of thread, and it's not the only thread, thankfully, in our country's history and culture, but this seems to be one happening again, where there is an intention to turn down the light on African history, contributions, cultures, and so forth. So yeah, I'll stop there and see, see how we might want to take it up.
Well, you had us captivated there for sure. But then let's take a moment because we had a great conversation with you. I guess we're probably about a year ago, maybe last summer. Just about Africana studies in general. I just think that there is, as I recall talking to you, this sense of kind of a revelation of the a real history. I mean, I think people who love history, I don't think it really matters whose history they're learning about. The fact that there are things that are being uncovered that nobody understood before, and then piecing these things together, the research that's being done. Let's just, you know, talk a little bit about that when it comes to Africana studies and how you approach things at Buffalo State.
Sure. One thing that we have recently done in the Africana Studies program at Buffalo State is we have created a new logo, and I'm bringing it up in response to your question because it comes with a nice kind of phrase that I think helps define and shed light on what Africana Studies is and is all about. And like anything, it can be defined in diverse ways, and they're all accurate, you know, but they take a different kind of angle or lens. But we say now Africana Studies, restoring the cosmos through deep African thought. Restoring the cosmos through deep African thought. And then before I unpack that a little bit, what the logo includes are Adinkra symbols, nine of them. They come from the Akan people of Ghana, okay? And each symbol is sort of beautiful, I think, in its own right, but also has a deep meaning. And because Africana Studies is multidisciplinary, a colleague of ours, Professor Aaron Habes in the fashion department, thought this up and designed it and wanted to emphasize the multidisciplinary connections of Africana Studies. So you'll see in the logo that it'll say sociology, political science, fashion, dance, philosophy, and so forth. All those feeder majors and disciplines that go into Africana Studies. But what holds all of them together as students are going from one fascinating course to another is this idea of restoring the cosmos through deep African thought. We're just doing it through different disciplines. Now, to understand this, I would guess someone would say, what do you mean by cosmos? And it essentially, we're referring to a way of living that's based on interconnectedness. Not the fact of it, because it's just factually true that we're all connected, but valuing it, you know, so that it should reflect in our mindsets, how we speak, how we interact with each other, behave, and so forth. And so restoring the cosmos suggests that something went awry, you know, at some point, and we're living by some other kind of order that's not based on that kind of interconnectedness. And we can come up with analytically strong, you know, ways of characterizing what this new order is. But one way to do it might be white supremacy is one anchor of this new order, and anti-blackness, let's say, is sort of a counter anchor, kind of holding this whole thing up that we call the modern world, maybe. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the more people adhere to these anchor points, in other words, what Europeans have done in the last 500 years is amazing, and it's what counts, and it, you know, we should get our names from there and our institutions from there, and everyone should learn European languages and so forth, to the same degree or in the same motion that we're running the heck away from anything African, mm-hmm. you know, as contributors. So, so insofar as we are able to live by that new order, and it feels like that new order is in place, it seems kind of like a cosmos, like the world makes sense, right? But in Africana studies, we would understand this as a broken cosmos. It's one based on hierarchy and difference, as opposed to that the interconnections, right, among us. In cognitive psychology, we learn about the idea of a slanted room. A slanted room. This is the idea that the people who are doing the research, conducting the studies, they'll create a room that doesn't meet expectations of right angles and perfect up and down and so on and so forth. They'll turn the light off in the room, and they'll bring someone into it, sit them down in a chair, turn the light on, and the task is for the person sitting to align themselves correctly in the room. And what often happens, they find, is the person will adjust and adjust and adjust until they feel like the right angles are in place, and up is up and down is down, and so on and so forth. But again, almost always they're literally slanted, sometimes at 45 degree angles, you know. But they're, again, they're studying the human mind, and there being something deep about us that wants to align ourselves with what we perceive as order, you know. And so, again, in Africana studies, I would think many of us, you know, would explain what's going on as a mad dash by people to try to get back to this slanted culture, this slanted order, you know, that makes people feel, some people feel comfortable if that's what they were socialized into and expect, you know, based on white supremacy, anti-blackness. So all that to say, Africana studies is the prescriptive lens for seeing the room as slanted, understanding where that came from, the conditions that it's produced, and maybe most importantly, how to get actually straight mm-hmm. up and down and restore this cosmos, so that I think the love we're supposed to feel for each other across superficial differences, the trust we're supposed to have without feeling like we're walking on eggshells, can be returned, you know. And it's not about utopia. There are societies now that operate much closer to that than I think we do, at least in our mainstream society. So it is possible, you know. It doesn't mean we'll be without conflict and so forth, but it will mean the conflict isn't based on dehumanizing somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do we get there? I mean, in terms of public policy, academic freedoms are being restricted, particularly African American history in high schools and, you know, Texas and Florida and other states. How do we get our policymakers to fight for our academic freedom and understanding the importance of Black studies and Africana studies?
That is a key question. They should take Africana studies courses.
Yes.
Good start.
Great.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many ways to get into that. I mean, I guess my first question to that would be, what's the resistance?
Yes.
And maybe a second question is, why wouldn't they know of the importance? And that gets into the psychology of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. You know, why does one people's quest for equality feel like a threat or discrimination or oppression to another group? You know, I've heard that being put forward as a definition of a symptom of white supremacy. Like, you're in it when there's talk of equality and people feel threatened by equality. You know, mm-hmm. what's the threat of, you know,
right.
of equity or being equal, you know, that kind of thing. So I would start there. And I guess a presumption being made is that all people want to know the deeper truths, or that they don't like something about the discriminations and inequalities. It works for some people, you know. So without getting political, the majority of Americans voted for Trump,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, and he won. So and that's not saying that everyone who voted for him has racial prejudice or anything like that, but there's clear evidence that his politics is racist, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. So that racism didn't throw everybody off the train. You know, some people could take that on and still vote for him with a good conscience, you know, even if they themselves might not, you know, have racial prejudice or think that they don't. So this works for a lot of people. And I think we need to start thinking very seriously about that. You know, a lot of times we're in the room with like-minded people and we can, you know, talk about social justice and largely agree and build on each other's ideas, but we end up being in a room of people who tend to agree and forget that not only are there other people outside that room who don't, but apparently the majority of Americans don't agree. And it might be policymakers. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be policymakers. It reminds me of when I study news headlines that involve race over the last few years. Almost all of them will say things like, police officer suspended for killing black male, something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, or restaurant owner being sued by black woman for harassment. Newsline after news headline, up to 20, 30, and I present this in classes sometimes too, they always erase the whiteness, mm-hmm. of the police officer or the restaurant owner or whoever did the racial act. But they don't, the same headline doesn't mind highlighting the brutality suffered by black bodies, mm-hmm. you know. So your question takes me there because, again, it's about the perspective of these policymakers. You know, are they living in a world where they presume that the guilt of whiteness should disappear? Is it something that is not a topic of conversation? And if so, there's already a block, if not a double block or triple block, on even reaching them, you know? So then the question is, how do you reach people who perhaps have been socialized to have a psychology that depends on these kinds of racial inequalities, you know, because now you're messing with someone at the core of their being, mm-hmm. you know, their existence. And so that strikes me as something that would need to be tackled, you know, even to try to get through to policymakers. Now, if they'll listen, you know, if they can either be talked to and be made open to listen, or if they're ready to listen, I think it would be just educating them on what Africana studies, for example, really is. Outside of hearing that term, do they really know? Probably not. If they're hearing Africana studies for the first time and we're talking with them, and I said, now say Africana studies. They might not even pronounce it right. You know,
just like the president mispronounced an African country the other night. Yes, right.
What was it,
right.
Uganda?
There you go. There you go. You know. So I don't know if that's an adequate answer, but it strikes me as layered and complicated, but doable. You know, but it would take that kind of step-by-step thoughtful process, so inviting them in.
So you feel, in the sense that if there was a scholarly or just an open conversation, an open series of conversations where these could be discussed, these policies could be discussed, and the value of Africana studies, and for that matter, like you just said, what Africana studies really are, that in the end, that would win out, that the value, the realization of Africana studies, what that could bring to this society, would win out with policymakers. If, in fact, they were searching for, I want to use the word equitable policy, but mm-hmm. the policies for everybody, the best policies available.
Yeah. I think it's a hopeful way to think about it.
Right.
Because I think it presumes that a lot of the inequalities that we're talking about are based on something rational, that people would respond to information and data and reason. Unfortunately, I think a lot of history suggests that they don't, right? And they won't. Some people will say we had the 1950s and the 1960s, and we had the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65 and the Housing Act of 68. So we should be done with this now, you know. Why are we still talking about it? And yet we know that little has changed statistically, you know, in terms of predicting health, right? Social well-being by race, you know, since then. So that kind of tells us that it's not just the changing of laws, right? It's not just even protesting that's been done all these years. It's not just the rational intaking of information, because we have had Black studies and Latin studies and women and gender studies and so forth, Indigenous studies. So I think we're dealing with something slipperier mm-hmm. than that. So I think it's a start. I mean, if a door opens, but then what the conversation is becomes important, you know. Is it just conveying information, or can we get real deep and talk about psychology and what's motivating this? Again, because I think my understanding is the way many of us are socialized into the society, our very way of being, our felt humanity is caught up, right, in what happens to be inequalities. And it would be interesting to see if we could make progress in that regard. One thing I can say that's related to this, the audience in this case isn't policymakers, but I don't see why it couldn't be. So the idea is this, that we are developing in Africana studies what we are calling, for now, an Africana community menu, and it's called, the subtitle is Black Knowledge Delivered. Black Knowledge Delivered. So the idea is to take key lessons that we learn in our Africana studies courses and bring them to a community of interest, right? It really doesn't matter, you know, what the community is. You know, we might start on the east side, but we'd be happy to take this to the West Side. So what it is essentially is we would ask hair salons, barbershops, libraries, coffee shops in the community if they'd be interested in hosting Africana Studies for 30 minutes, maybe an hour, where we would come in on a day and time they choose, and we would offer a short lesson, you know, on something that we learn or that we teach in our Africana Studies courses. But it's a way of getting that information out there, right? So on the one hand, this is very Africana Studies-ish to be one with the community, right? When Africana Studies starts in the 1960s, it comes with a criticism of the dominant form of education, which we can call Eurocentric. And that was sort of the idea that knowledge is this thing that is in the head of an expert. That person stands in a closed room and dumps that expertise into the empty or empty-ish heads of students.
Right.
And that whatever ends up circulating there kind of stays there, right, and doesn't go beyond the walls of the classroom. So Africana Studies wasn't brought into history to do education that way, right? It was always designed to be critically connected with the community. It's that cosmos idea. We're all in this together. And it's not only that, yes, we're trained for long periods of time, and so we have something to offer, but in the training that's Africana Studies or close to Africana Studies, we also learn to value that everyone has intelligence, right? Based on their life experiences. It might be perfectly well adapted to a life, for example, on the East Side, you know, that helps people get through their day and figure it out. But that's knowledge that we value. And we want to learn, right, from people there just as much as we think we can teach some things. So we do have that kind of outreach. If policymakers want to, you know, call us up and say, hey, can you give us a 30-minute hour lecture on this and this? We'll be there. You know? And it'll probably be at least a faculty member and a student or two, right, involved.
So. Which is what we need right now. Well, we're going to head into our break. And when we return to What's Next, we're going to dive into that Black Studies menu right there.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
This is What's Next on WBFO.
Our mission at Buffalo Toronto Public Media is to serve our local community. And on WBFO, we do that by keeping you informed. We bring you important perspectives from your neighbors on What's Next.
It's cultural heritage tourism. People go and they travel different places to learn about history and lived experiences that only took place in that area. Oftentimes you may have people in certain positions that don't understand the value of cultural heritage tourism.
And we investigate issues in our community, such as racial disparities and traffic stops.
The data breakdown by council district shows that Black people are stopped disproportionately to their population in all 9 districts. Lovejoy District leads the pack in terms of those disproportionate stops. Just 37% of the district's population is Black, yet Black motorists account for almost 70% of stop receipts issued there.
This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to What's Next. I'm Naila Ansari, and I'm excited I'm co-hosting today with Jay.
Thanks, Naila.
Woohoo! Yep. We've been with Dr. Marcus Watson, Associate Professor in Africana Studies and the Program Coordinator at Buffalo State University, and we've been diving deep into Africana Studies. I know a lot, but I'm learning more just listening to you right now. And, you know, we've been talking about activism and what role does that play with our students? What are some of the things that, our students are currently doing in terms of fighting and resistance on some of these current policy changes?
Yes. The question of activism is key. And what does activism mean, you know, is also something. Some people, it might bring the image of kind of protesting and you know, holding up signs and that kind of thing. But, you know, we try to convey to the students that activism really just means what you're learning should be made relevant. It should actually do something in the world and hopefully help someone. And the broader goal is restoring the cosmos. Okay. All right. So when it comes to our students, there isn't a palpable uptick in their sense that they want to do something in the world. They want to be active. And I think that, first of all, that's the kind of student often drawn to Africana Studies. It doesn't have to be the only kind of students. And Africana Studies is for everyone,
right?
Yes,
I should say.
Right?
when we're teaching about African history and culture and behaviors and so forth, all the students learning about it probably came through a very similar education system. And so they have an equal number of blind spots, right, about that, including Black students, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, Black students are learning more about, oh, I come from somebody and we have done great things and we have contributed to this country and to the world. Non-Black students are learning who's sitting next to them, right? Or who's, you know, on the football team with them. And so that they can bring more respect and understanding to those relationships. So all that to say, Africana Studies is as much for everyone as biology is, or anthropology is, or dance, or any other discipline. So about 2 weeks ago, we had what was called an Africana Studies Week during Black History Month, if there still is such a thing. That's a half joke, you know. But,
I thought we were talking about it, but maybe that's really ancient history.
Right, right.
We know every month is Black History Month. And it's everybody's History Month as well. So we had Africana Studies Week, and we put on several events. They were highlighted by John Elmore coming in and talking to students about policing and the law and how to see things when it comes to Black community interactions with police and proper behavior, behaviors that keep you alive and so on and so forth. We also had a great event featuring alumni of African ancestry who came, big crowds for those two events. And what came out of that was student interest in doing something. I think these particular students, but maybe this generation in general, they ask this question, what is the point? I've literally heard that question asked multiple times by different people. But even when it's not those words, it's phrased in different ways to mean that. You know, the generation, I think, really wants to know, what is the point?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What is the point? And they mean everything from, what is the point of life? But in an Africana context, it's like, I get this, this is interesting, but what's the point of still, you know, agitating for a just world? And they'll talk to me about, this has been done before. We've protested, laws have been changed, nothing seems to stop it. So they ask, what's the point? And so I think, again, one ironically good thing from an Africana perspective that, and maybe just from a justice perspective, that came out of this recent election and the current political climate is that students are seeing now more than they used to an answer mm-hmm. to that question, right? They understand that maybe they've been responding to symptoms of, in this case, you know, white supremacy. They hear about a black woman's killed in Chicago, but they can sort of say, well, that's terrible, but it wasn't me. I'm still on track for what I need to do. You know, the Tops massacre, you know, May 14th, you know, another thing that it hit so many of us hard, you know. But I think some people, I don't know if it's the way this generation is socialized, but they can still manage to say, they can shed a tear even and say it's terrible, but it's not me. Mm-hmm. You know, responding to symptoms, you know, instead of thinking, wait a minute, that killer didn't care who those black people were. So it could have been me. It could have been my auntie. It could have been my, you know, it's that close. So I think they're starting to connect those dots. And these events I just mentioned that happened a couple of weeks ago seem to be a kind of last domino that needed to fall for at least these several students to say, you know what? I'm tired of sitting on my hands. I can see more clearly now than I could before that this does, what's happening affects me. And there's something I can do. The alumni in particular, when they talked about being at Buffalo State decades prior, they talked about being more unified. They talked about using university resources to go on excursions and learn. They talked about being active, you know, being socially conscious. And so I think that event in particular, you know, really sparked the energies of some of these students. And so a couple of them want to start an Africana club, student club, where like-minded individuals, they might be majors, but it might extend beyond that, can come together and talk about how they can change the world, you know, maybe starting on campus, maybe starting in the community here, but that their voices as students and voices of this generation, they do matter. They can make a difference. And that's one example of so things that they want to do. For example, they want to have a book club where maybe some of the books that are banned, right, are being read. Right, going back to that metaphor from the 1830s of this attempt to extinguish the light, you know. They don't want the light to be extinguished. You know, they want to shed light on, many of them are of African ancestry, but not all, but they want to shed light on their past, you know, and their heroes and the contributions they've made to this country. They don't want that to be, invisible or silent. So that book club is one sort of thing, and they're still developing it.
You know? Right.
And so they'll have other kind of ideas.
Since we touched on the book club and banned books for just a second here, and I think it might be worthwhile I don't want to put you on the spot, you know, because you were up early this morning doing your scholarly writings and such. But let's, you know, maybe I'll mention a few of those books that perhaps the students were interested in.
So Malcolm X's autobiography, The Bluest Eye. I know some of Nikki Giovanni's poetry books are on there. Maybe Franz Fanon, you know, folks like that. Maybe books that are centered on Afrocentric theory. They want to know, they want to read those things. Again, they're coming from the perspective of they're seeing that we are living in a broken cosmos, in a cancerous cosmos, you know, however we want to say it. And that people of color, people of African ancestry in particular, black and indigenous women even more particularly, are struggling the most, you know, in this kind of cancerous cosmos. And because they're learning that and they know of their own strength and humanity and the value that they can bring to family and community and to the nation and to the world. They want to read the things that help them understand, again, how we got here, what are the conditions we're in, and what levers need to be pushed to straighten this out so that we can bring back, you know, the green grass of true freedom and the love and trust that I think we're supposed to be having for one another. Some of these students who are participating also went on a study abroad program that we had to Ghana in West Africa. And speaking with them about their experiences, but also observing these students there, I could hear that they finally understood that there is a way to be a human being that is based on humanizing each other, not trying to filter each other through categories. You're this kind of person, you're that kind of person, and then getting hung up on, are you playing out your role, or you're not playing out your role, and you have to do that. You know, these are kind of subconscious things a lot, but they remarked in Ghana about, first of all, just the easygoing friendliness of everyone. They noticed one time we were on a bus and we were parked, and in front of us pulled a public transportation. It's a minivan, right? But it serves as a kind of public transportation, like a taxi. A woman gets off and she's holding two heavy kind of boxes. And you can tell she's kind of looking around for help. She's going to eventually put these on her head and then walk with them either home or to a market to sell or something. And someone just, a guy comes out of the blue and he can see that she needs help and just helps her. And there wasn't even like a thank you or anything exchanged. It was just done and he left and she did her thing. And the students saw that and remarked on it. And they would say things like, man, that couldn't happen in New York City. But it's par for course. It's the norm in Ghana, you know. And it was a dream come true to see some of our students go and see and observe things I might talk to them about in class, you know. Or I may exude in my own behavior, just being friendly, you know. I don't know if that's the first word that comes to mind when you think of a professor, you know, because it's like erudite and, you know,
perfect.
And it might even be like even more distant, you know, sometimes. But you know, those of us in Africana studies, you included Naila, Dr. Tori, and Dr. Hawson, and those of us, we tend to have more of an Africana ethos, I think, to how we interact. And so I could even see just being friendly, you know, to students can sometimes seem like it was a bit much for them. Like, are we sure this is what, but having some of them go to the continent, to Ghana in particular, and just witness what friendliness can be. And it doesn't mean it's a utopia, again, that there can be fights and tensions and so forth, but it's happening in a context of interrelatedness, right? So the humanity of people, even you're fighting with, is never lost, you know. So it was some of those students, not exclusively, but, you know, who are interested in saying, I can now more clearly see a new way, right? A new world. And they want to see what they can do in their short time at Buffalo State to, you know, restore the cosmos to the extent possible.
I'm going to throw this actually at the interviewer. I'm going to ask the interviewee. But you mentioned the Africana ethos that you share, Naila and Dr. Watson. Can you expand on that a little bit? We're here on the radio. Yes. We can only use our words, but what, expand on what that means to you.
I would say it's a community that's different than what people typically think in terms of academia, because Africana Studies is inherently part of the community. So we don't live in this ivory tower. We don't get to do that because we have to have the community involved. And what that means is also engaging with our students as if we would anyone in our community, which sometimes can be a relationship that might seem like mother to child. It could be cousin to cousin. It can be auntie to, you know, niece or nephew. And because we all need that in order to survive. Not only are we trying to survive in the world, we're also trying to survive in academia. And it's so interesting because we talk about humanity. I treat all of my students the same, but particularly my non-Black students, it's so interesting when they leave Africana that they end up getting a little swaggy, as we say, because they, you know, they're invested in the conversations, but they're also invested in justice, and they're invested in all of us being a part of humanity in a ways in which they know that we should be, and that we should have some type of equity and equality when we look at the world, and that we become a family. And I know that sounds so odd to some people that work in academia, because some people don't even know their students' names, and particularly like big lecture halls, but we don't function that way. Like, even in our intro classes, you know, when you leave, you almost get a little teary-eyed because you start to really have these kind of difficult conversations in the classroom that makes us a community, because we all realize that we're in the fight together. And, you know, I say this all the time, particularly with Black women, but when Black women prevail, we all prevail. And when Black folks prevail, we all prevail. And that's the understanding that we have in our classes. And so, you know, I've had some kind of like, you know, tech kind of bro, you know, white dudes and like very suburban white girls, they come out and they're like, fight the power like Nikki Giovanni, which was, you know, some of our strongest allies that are in the community now, that, you know, we've had internships, and now, you know, one of them is working at MNC Bank, particularly with equity and diversity. And she's a white woman. And she came out of our program and is a strong advocate. But it's because it's centered around community and family first.
Anything to add to that, Doctor?
I mean, that was so profoundly said. I guess I'll add to that by saying, because we start with a kind of African-centered philosophy, right? That cosmos idea, the interconnectedness idea. That means that our language practices, you know, are just tend to be inclusive. You know, we have a lot of the mainstream society fighting for inclusion. And I think it's something we do in a way that feels natural. You know, I learned from my father, for example, and my mother that, you know, I like to use we, you know, we who are white, we who are Black, we who are LGBTQ, you know, just to emphasize that inclusiveness, right, of us, that comes with a worldview that's associated with Africana Studies. But it's more routine and daily than that. When many of us who grow up in around Black communities, we know this phenomenon of you meet somebody and they introduce you to their cousin, you know. Only to find out they're not related at all, right, you know, from a Eurocentric point of view, right?
Okay.
Right. Right. And we say brother and sister, like we, and this goes back to the continent. You know, it's happening right now as we speak on the continent. Strangers become friends. Friends become cousins. Cousins become brothers and sisters. Every elder is mother and father. And people have obligations based on those relationships. So the way language is used, it's used to bring people in and closer. And if you think about kind of Eurocentric ways of doing the same kind of thing, the emphasis is on, is that your second cousin, first cousin? Is it the third one? What's like the trajectory is outward. You know, we're trying to trace people out, right? But that's not the philosophical you know, character of Africana Studies. So that I'll just add that comes through, you know, in our mindsets and in how we embrace students and each other. And they see us as colleagues interacting as brother and sister. And sometimes you can hear them, you know, talking like, they're so cool how they, you know, talk to each other and they're close. And yeah, so we have community, you know, community with our students, community among faculty, community Africana, and the community, you know.
And I may just add, I guess I'll use the word ironic. I always use it incorrectly, but you're talking about on the continent, this closeness, this sense of community. Mm-hmm. But here on this continent, the North American continent, it seems all we keep hearing about are communities, and we're talking about probably, obviously, in most cases, white communities, people who are not talking to each other, mm-hmm. who are not communicating with each other, people who do not want to be part of each other's communities anymore. I don't necessarily have to comment on that, but I just thought it was, it came to light as you were speaking.
Yeah, I think there are contrasts like that, generally speaking, cross-culturally. You know, it's not a zero-sum type of thing, but yeah, we struggle, I think, at least in our dominant culture, to be together. Or if we are together, it's a sense of solidarity based on hating somebody else.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And that is a pathological, you know, form of bonding, I would say, and something that needs to be unpacked. I would even say it might be from Africana studies, or at least certain segments of Africana studies, that the thought about people on the left and people on the right now in our current political, not being able to talk, like that's a problem from a certain Africana perspective. Even if personally we find ourselves on one side of that or the other. But I think stepping back from the personal, just understanding the spirit of Africana, we want to look at that and say, so, for example, some Democrats, they almost don't see the humanity, it seems, mm-hmm. in some Republicans, and vice versa. Some Republicans don't even see the humanity in Democrats. And that strikes a certain Africana chord as a Eurocentric way of relating, you know. And sometimes it's even within families.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
families, not know. That I'm speaking for my family.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so our society has amazing things about it. You know, it's not a throw the baby away with the bath. That's mm-hmm. a terrible matter, but you know, that kind of thing. It's not that. We have amazing things. I think we have a chance to make a bold statement to the world about how we should be as human beings on the earth. You know, everything that's happened, it still might be us here in the States who can find out how to, you know, fix this. But we have material things, conveniences, which a lot of us like, and it's really cool, and it's helped in terms of indicators of health, even though that's broken down racially, so it helps some more than others, you know. But when it comes to how to relate to another human being, I don't think we can touch much of the African continent, for example. You know, when it comes to understanding love, friendship, I don't think we can touch much of the African continent. We have things to learn from each other, and a lot of that's coming through Africana studies. So if you know, a lot of it is about taking the wisdoms, you know, of Africana studies, and how do we apply it, you know, not to displace anything, but to make things better, more humane. And it would take people who benefit from the current way things are done to take a second and imagine that life could be such that they could actually feel good around people who maybe they currently don't feel good around, and how much better life would be for them, for their children, and so forth. It's a big ask, but you know,
it's a great ask.
Yes. Well, if we can close out today, can you give us something that we can all do to keep Africana studies alive?
Well, we are, get the word out there, please. The name Africana Studies, what we're about, We come from different disciplines: dance, philosophy, political science, education, psychology. I'm going to forget some, but we're multidisciplinary. But what holds us together is our expertise in restoring the cosmos through deep African thought. So if you can remember the name, what we're about, we are doing fundraising. We have ideas for trying to get this message and our knowledge out there, but we need capacity building to do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if there are listeners who are feeling what we're saying and are so inclined, there are ways to help us build capacity and try to fix the future, you know, if not for ourselves, then for the innocent ones, the yet to be borns.
Thank you, Dr. Watson. Thank you, Jay, for having me on.
Oh, this has been great. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And we close out with What's Next. We look forward to seeing you soon and support Africana Studies.
Thanks for being with us today. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.